Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. Coming to you live from London, I'm Krupa Bharti. Thank you for being with us. We begin the programme in Ukraine, where the United States has said it believes there are around 8,000 soldiers from North Korea deployed in the Russian region of Kursk. That's a territory where Ukraine made an incursion this summer. And this brings the possibility of a direct conflict between Ukrainian and North Korean troops ever closer. We will ask what that means for the war in a moment. But first to the Kherson region inside Ukraine. A BBC investigation has found evidence of Russia's increasingly use of drones to target civilians. The Ukrainian government says there's been a sudden surge in drone attacks on civilians in the southern region in the past 3 months, in which at least 30 people have been killed and more than 400 injured. Russia's military has not responded to the BBC's questions about the allegations. From Kherson, Yogita Limay reports with Imogen Anderson and Sanjay Gangwal.
In the city of Kherson, there are constantly drones hovering over us. It is a constant threat, and the only real mitigation against that is to drive at a really high speed. So that's what we're doing right now, to get from place to place.
In what is considered a relatively safe area in the city, we meet Dmytro, a 22-year-old volunteer who's one of more than 400 civilians injured in drone attacks since the 1st of August.
He's got an injury to his ear. In fact, he's still got shrapnel lodged close to his ear because the doctor says it's too dangerous to try to take it out. And he's also got a video of how exactly the incident happened, which he's going to show us now.
In the video, a drone can be seen as it buzzes over a makeshift bus stop. Then it fires. Is everyone okay? A man shouts. The camera then shows Dmytro, blood gushing from his right ear.
The drone attacks have intensified since July. And it's not 5 or 10 of them, it's hundreds of them. They constantly circle, from morning till night, every day. The Russians are deliberately targeting civilians. They have a Telegram channel on which they post footage from the drones of how they are hunting for cars and people in Kherson.
Dozens of civilians have been killed in drone attacks. Serhii, a local trader, was hit by shrapnel when he was in the backyard of his home. His wife, Angela, saw it happen. She broke down as she spoke to us.
When he heard the drone, he tried to hide under a tree, but it was so quick. Shrapnel pierced his heart. He was such a good man. Is this the way the Russians have decided to fight? By just killing civilians who walk in the street?
Just a few minutes' drive away, I've come to an automobile repair shop in Kherson, where we're meeting a woman, Olena, who had gone into a building to get a manicure, and then she heard a loud explosion. When she came out, she found a drone had dropped a bomb on her car. There's a huge hole in the roof where something's gone through it. The car seats are fully ripped apart. The door frame has come loose. There are shreds and little bits of plastic and metal and wire just scattered all over the floor.
I don't look like a military person. My car is not a military car. Don't they see that?
We go further into the city to one of a handful of aid distribution centres operating in Kherson.
The sound you hear there, that's a drone detector telling us that there are drones overhead. I'm just looking at the screen and there are at least four. We're at a centre where a charity distributes food and supplies to residents in Kherson. We've been hearing lots of artillery shelling as well in the last 10 minutes or so. So there's multiple threats here. We've had to run in very quickly from our car into this building. And we can see people coming in, mostly elderly people who are going to come in to get here some food and supplies.
Bendu Singh, who runs the aid centre, explains why drones are more terrifying than shelling.
It's the enormous difference. So the artillery, there's patterns to the shelling. It's very, very nuanced, but if you're here long enough, you kind of pick those things up, and the people generally manage to live that way. It didn't immobilize the population. The shelling is indiscriminate, but a drone locks on you, and the truth is that's probably game over. You have almost no chance at that point. That's the difference.
Trauma is visible on the faces of everyone we meet at the aid centre. They tell us they're worried things will get worse, that as winter approaches and the leaves fall from the trees, there will be fewer places to hide.
Yogita Limai reporting there with colleagues Imogen Anderson and Sanjay Ganguly. Well, let's stay with Ukraine and look at the US concern now over the presence of North Korean troops close to the front line. Here's the US Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin speaking in Washington a short time ago.
Our assessment is that Putin's forces have trained these North Korean soldiers in artillery operations, UAV operations, and basic infantry operations, including trench clearing. The Kremlin has also provided these DPRK troops with Russian uniforms and equipment. And all of that strongly indicates that Russia intends to use these foreign forces in frontline operations in its war of choice against Ukraine.
Well, Brendan Kearney is a retired colonel who spent 31 years in the U.S. Marine Corps. His last assignment was as Chief of Staff of Marine Forces Europe, which required extensive work within NATO. I asked him what impact this will have on the ground.
I don't really believe it's going to have a tremendous impact. You've got North Korean forces that, poorly led, poorly equipped, no experience in combat. And here they are going up against Ukrainian forces that are among the most experienced combat fighters in the world right now. I really think this is going to turn out to be a tragedy for the North Koreans, if anybody in North Korea cared.
We do know that this will, in theory, add an additional 10,000 troops to the Russian capacity. And we're in a place where Ukrainian forces are already talking about low spirit, low morale. Will this not have an impact on the dynamic in any way?
Oh, I think it will. I see the North Koreans as really being placed in a position where they're going to become casualties. And they're going to become casualties very, very quickly at the hands of the Ukrainian forces. And that, even that is going to be, can you imagine being a North Korean soldier wounded and ending up in a Russian hospital where there is no language ability between the two countries. They're incomprehensible. So this is going to pose a logistics challenge to the Russians and to the North Koreans as they try to repatriate their wounded and their dead home, if they try to do that.
And briefly, what kind of a response might we anticipate from the U.S. should this go ahead?
You know, I don't think the U.S. is going to do much publicly other than condemn. But, you know, as Secretary Austin said, there's going to be further announcements about increasing supplies to the Ukrainians. So I think there will be more equipment and munitions going to Ukraine from the U.S., but also I think we're going to see an increase from South Korea. They make some of the finest military equipment in the world, and I see them getting more involved in shipping equipment to Ukraine.
Retired U.S. Marine Corps Colonel Brendan Kearney there. It's time for me to introduce you to a new artist on the block. Her name's Ada, and her latest piece is called AI God Portrait of Alan Turing. And here's the catch. Ada is a humanoid robot whose work will be the first of its kind sold by the auction house Sotheby's. Here she is talking about the work.
I have created a series of five portraits that make up Elliptic, which explore the legacy of AI, with portraits of Ada Lovelace, Alan Turing, and myself, through the lens of technological transformation over time.
Aidan Meller, who created Ada with a team of scientists from Oxford University, told me more.
What I've really tried to get into is what is actually happening here. We're hearing AI in lots of different forms, in all sorts of industries affecting them. What's the big theme, though? And I'm starting to realize, only just now, 5 years into doing this every day, and what I'm clocking is actually the agency of human decision making is being transferred from the human to the machine. Mm-hmm. So whether you do Spotify or whether you do your sat-nav, you now trust the sat-nav to take you where it wants to go. You trust the Spotify to come up with music you want to listen to.
But here's the thing, Aidan, isn't that hugely worrying for human artists?
Yes, well, beyond human artists, all humanity. If you are going to the algorithms in 10 years' time for what job you're going to do, what partner you're going to date, what kind of family you're going to have, what kind of health you're going to have, what kind of food, the algorithms will be able to, because the vast data sets involved, the accuracy will be mind-blowingly good. So you'll trust it. And the Ada has just released this artwork. And the idea is to say, well, actually, if we do trust this algorithm, if we do trust this ability for it to make decisions for on our behalf, it's got a godlike quality to it. We trust it. We follow it. We are allowing it to make those decisions for us. And this artwork, we hope, will provoke the question, is that what we want?
So those are questions for wider society that we are all grappling with. But artists in particular, I'm keen to better understand their reaction, their concerns, the positive things that they've said about this.
I think it's a whole polarized thing. I think some artists are embracing it, go, wow, new tools, a bit like the camera in the 1850s. Let's go for this. Let's go and develop where it can go. And of course, there's going to be a whole swathe of artists going, oh my gosh, this is threatening and horrible. And they're stealing our pictures and all the rest of it. Just out of interest, Ada does the majority of her works by looking. She has cameras in her eyes. Most of the imagery that she takes in is actually through by what she sees through those cameras. So I'm really sympathetic to the upset that it's causing, because obviously the artist's data is being used to create artworks. But actually, more importantly, what is that going to be? Is that going to be a different industry? Is that going to be complementary to the artists? I think some of the worries are going to drop away, just like they were about the camera. They just start to use it in a different way and it becomes a different thing. Certainly didn't stop painters painting. And I think there's probably going to be an AI art world alongside the traditional art world. But yes, I completely sympathise with the plight of the artists at the moment. And I think it is frightening.
Aidan Meller, who created Ada with a team of scientists from Oxford University. That auction has started. It's due to end on the 7th of November. So let's see how much that painting goes for. Coming up, what the political polarisation in the US means for its image abroad. We'll hear from author and political scientist Francis Fukuyama.
There's been a huge damage to American soft power, right? The soft power means the power that we project because people admire the United States. They think that the system is an exemplary democracy. And I think it gets harder and harder for people to maintain that belief when the country is willing to re-elect somebody like Donald Trump.
And that's coming up in around 30 minutes' time. Meanwhile, the headlines. The Spanish government says dozens of people are missing following flash floods, which have killed more than 150 people. More on that in a moment. And the US says there are now 8,000 North Korean troops in the Russian region of Kursk, where they've been deployed to help the war against Ukraine. This is Krupa Party with NewsHour, live from London's New Broadcasting House. Emergency teams in Spain are continuing their search and rescue operations, where some 158 people are now known to have died after flash floods hit parts of the country on Wednesday. Arturo Valoria de Arana is one of the Red Cross volunteers currently in Valencia. He told NewsHour that hundreds of people were trapped in shelters.
Right now we are in one of the shelters in Valencia city, and this shelter is more or less around 600 people. They're trying to recover as soon as possible their normal lives. And many people were in Valencia working or just passing, you know, travel from home. They are just trapped here in Valencia, and many other people here in these shelters are coming from the surrounding small towns, waiting to know about the roads in order to reach their homes. Life has changed completely. A lot of people has lost their cars, so they're really shocked here in shelters.
The Prime Minister, Pedro Sanchez, who is visiting areas devastated by the flash floods, said the authorities were using all their resources to find the missing, to restore basic services and to rebuild.
I would like, first of all, after this meeting, to pass on to the people who live in Valencia and also Castellón, please, the high-altitude isolated depression continues. Please do not go out. Stay home. Follow the alerts from the emergency services. Follow all their requirements, all their recommendations, because at the moment, the most important thing is to save as many lives as possible.
The BBC's Nicky Schiller is in Valencia, and he told me what he could see on the ground.
So I am in an area of the city called La Torre, which has been really badly hit. You can't get in here by car. You have to walk into here, and you walk about 2 kilometres, and everywhere there are those overturned cars that you have probably seen on social media or on the television pictures, just tossed in the air like matchsticks. Right now, I can see 2 JCB diggers trying to start to move some of those cars and put them away out of the absolute devastation that is in this area. And it is not just the cars, but there is this mud, and it is horribly thick mud that is everywhere in this area because it inundated people's homes. And something that really brought it home to me earlier, Krupa, there was a young woman sitting on the pavement and she had a ring binder folder there, but it was covered in mud, and she was trying to get that mud off that ring binder because obviously there was something really important to her inside there. And it is those little things that they are struggling with. They also earlier on were saying they weren't getting enough help from the authorities. They needed food, they needed water, and they needed medicine. But I've actually stood outside a church in this area, and they are operating, organised by the city council, for people from the city centre to bring clothes, food, baby items, toiletries. And there has been a huge steady stream of people coming into the church, and particularly water. There was a human chain here earlier taking water and putting it into the church. It lasted for about an hour, where they were just taking bottled water into the church for people to have here. And earlier, people going into the city to try and buy bottled water. And also the other thing that I saw them buying was bleach, because of course they're going to have to try and start cleaning their homes. But Krupa, this is not something that is going to happen in days, weeks or months. This is going to be years for this particular area to recover from that huge floodwater that surged down this particular street.
What support are people getting from state level, from the authorities?
So this is the question that a lot of them had asked. So there has been a lot of angry people, I have to say, earlier on today, because for two reasons. One, they don't think they got the warning early enough of the flood. So people were saying that they only got a message within minutes of water starting to appear, and within half an hour it was a metre and a half deep. So they were angry that the authorities didn't alert them quickly enough to the fact that there could be a flood. And then they have been angry that they haven't got the resources in. And I have to say, when I got here first thing this morning, there were police here, but there wasn't much other operation. Mm. But tonight, that seems to be kicking in, where we have the local authorities here and the JCBs and the police trying to clear up in this particular area of the city, Krupa.
BBC reporter Nikki Schiller for us there in Valencia. Well, I've been speaking to Robin Sapena-Prosser. He lives in the town of Torrent, but has been going to one of the most affected villages by Borda to help those impacted there. He told me about his day.
This morning we left our city, Torrent, to help out in the nearby cities of Paiporta and Picanha. We were basically bringing supplies to the family and friends that we have over there. The only way to get there, well, we were able to drive a little bit down, and then from there we had to go walking through a lot of mud. Basically, once you get to cities like Picanha and Paiporta, all you would see is cars sideways, cars just turned around, cars on top of each other. Like I said, a lot of mud, debris everywhere. Once we got to Paiporta, we basically found that the railway of the subway was completely gone. And the older buildings had crumbled, the newer buildings were okay, but the ground floor of those buildings was completely destroyed.
And Robin, I understand you have family in Paiporta.
Yes, we have family in Paiporta. They're all okay. We have a lot of friends in Paiporta. Lives are okay, but of course, material damage is very severe. And we know there's been a lot of casualties and fatalities. Thankfully, none close to us, but we've heard of a lot of sad stories and people trying to get people out of cars and people trying to get people out of those ground floors and parking lots. It's been very hard.
Yes, I'm reassured to hear that your family and friends are okay, but there are, of course, still many people who are missing.
Correct. A lot of people who didn't receive that alert on time, the national alert, would basically go down to the parking lots and the garages to try and get their cars out when the water was coming up. Some people were trapped in there. There's still a lot of garages that they need to basically search.
You're going down there to help with your bare hands, but do the local people there feel that they are getting enough resources from authorities?
The access to get to those villages has been completely blocked. Bridges have collapsed. Only today we saw a lot of, you know, firemen, policemen, and a lot of different military people helping out in those areas because they just couldn't get there before.
And I guess linked to that is the question of access to information. You highlighted there that some people didn't feel like they got the alert on time. What about now? Are they getting the information they need, especially in light of the talk about misinformation spreading around these floods?
There's been a lot of misinformation since the very beginning, a lot of WhatsApp messages of fake news. I remember yesterday, for example, when the catastrophe was still there and it was hard to get to these places, we would get these WhatsApp messages, forwarded WhatsApp messages in mass, that would basically say that there was a dam further up that had collapsed, so another flood was coming. You would turn on the news and there would be mayors and presidents and people talking about these fake news and trying to let the people know that there was no dam collapsing, there are no more floods coming. Please stick to official news channels so that you can really know what's going on.
And that was Robin Sapena-Prosser, who's been helping people in the neighbouring town of Paiporta in Valencia, where a river burst its banks and at least 40 deaths have been recorded so far. Many more are missing, as we were hearing from Robin there. And we have that figure of 158 people who have died in what has become Spain's worst flooding disaster in generations.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.
Welcome back. Here in England and in Wales, a buffer zone has come into effect in front of abortion clinics. From now on, it will be illegal to protest within 150 metres of a clinic or try to influence someone's decision. Those who break this law will face an unlimited fine. Silent prayer, which has been the point of contention, is not an automatic offence, but people doing this within the zones could now be liable for prosecution. For more, I've been speaking to Louise McCudden from MSI, a charity that provides reproductive health services worldwide.
From today, the law says that anybody with an intention to influence your decision to access abortion care or obstruct your access to abortion care, and any behaviours that make women feel harassed, alarmed or distressed, are no longer lawful under this law. It's going to make a huge difference to a lot of women. At the moment, about 100,000 women a year, that's 2,000 women a week, are accessing abortion care at a clinic or a hospital which has been targeted by these sorts of harassment.
And what is it that these women are experiencing when they go to these clinics?
The behaviours range from sometimes calling women murderers, sometimes shouting out, mummy, mummy, while they're going in to access care. Sometimes they have cameras and they're taking photographs and they hand out medical misinformation. And nobody deserves to be harassed in this way, and confidentiality is important for everybody. But when you think about how some of the women accessing care are already particularly vulnerable, they might have been assaulted, they might have an abusive partner, they might have really serious confidentiality issues. You can imagine that being told that they've sinned and they're going to hell, or seeing people there with cameras, can be deeply, deeply distressing.
What is the response from the people who are outside those clinics praying, passing those comments? What do they say about why they are there?
Well, they like to sometimes say they're offering support and advice, but frankly, it's not support or advice if the information you're giving is medically wrong. They're not presenting alternatives or offering information. They're trying to coerce women into one particular outcome over another. When we have women come to us, we give them a consultation, and some do decide not to have an abortion. And of course, that's perfectly fine. What these groups are doing is coercing, bullying, trying to manipulate people.
Louise, we are, no surprise, covering the US elections extensively at the moment, and one of the big talking points has been the overturning of Roe versus Wade in the United States. A lot of people may be surprised to hear that this is happening in the UK.
Yes, it seems to us that we have seen an increase in activity outside our clinics since the repeal of Roe v. Wade in the US. We certainly know that anti-choice groups here use it in their campaign materials, and they feel emboldened by it. And we've seen groups like the US-based Alliance for Defending Freedom reportedly doubling their spend in the UK to nearly £1 million. So it is really concerning, and with the rise of misinformation and potential rollbacks on reproductive rights elsewhere in the world, we are watching the US with trepidation, because what happens in America does impact the rest of the world as well.
And that was Louise McCudden, UK Head of External Affairs at the Reproductive Health Service charity MSI. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. I'm Krupa Pardee. We turn next to the northeast African country of Sudan and the war facing its people. About 9 million people have been forced to flee their homes. And even before the war started, Sudan was one of the poorest countries in the world. Now, civil society groups are warning that women are so fearful of sexual assault as the war continues that they are prepared to take their own lives. Just a warning, there are references to sexual violence coming up. BBC Africa security correspondent is Ian Wafula, who's been following up on these reports.
I can at least confirm of four cases. One is because I chatted with one girl who said her own sister had taken her own life. But I tried to advance this conversation, but it was difficult because it was happening over Facebook. And this girl was in Khartoum. And because of internet outages, I've not heard from her again. She literally just left a message that my sister took her own life after sexual violations by the RSF. But then I continued to follow further, and I managed to speak to Hala Al-Karib, who is the executive director of the Strategic Initiative for Women in the Horn of Africa. And the organization actually documents gender-based violence against women especially. And she said that they have so far recorded 3 cases of suicide by women who were unfortunately raped by RSF soldiers. In fact, if I can go ahead to give one example is of a woman who was raped in front of her brother and father before the RSF went on to murder them. And therefore, she could not take at all what had just happened to her. You know, the loss of family and also being violated in front of them.
More details from the BBC's Ian Wafula there. The war began in April 2023 when Sudan's army and the powerful paramilitary group, the Rapid Support Forces, began a struggle for power. I've been getting the views of Khalid Yusuf, the vice chair of the National Congress Party, that's the party that is currently in power, and a member of the Tagudem, which is a cross-party coalition which aims to stop the war in Sudan via negotiations. First on the coalition and what they hope to achieve.
The purpose of this roundtable is to come out with a solution, because now the two fighting parties are increasing the destruction all over Sudan and the suffering of the Sudanese people. And the Sudanese people need a voice to speak about their suffering. So we are advancing the agenda of the protection of civilians as number one priority for us. We are coming with suggestions to achieve this goal and as well call the world to do something for Sudan.
The Sudanese Attorney General has previously accused Tagudem of being involved with accusations of war crime, genocide, ethnic cleansing and forced displacement. He said that the coalition is a political supporter of the RSF and provides media backing, for example. I'm wondering what your response is to those allegations.
It's complete nonsense. It is driven by political motivation. And these authorities, it linked to the former regime of the Islamist, of al-Bashir. They are look for this war as a way to retaliate from the civilians who are, through peaceful means of resistance, toppled al-Bashir regime.
But it is true that the leader of your coalition has met with the RSF leader himself.
The leader of our coalition are in contact with the two fighting sides with one aim, is to reach for peace in Sudan. Last December, we sent a letter to General Burhan and to General Hemeti suggesting some ideas about the protection of civilians, the delivery of the humanitarian aid, and how to stop the war. And our contact with the two fighting sides is one of our tools to bring peace to Sudan. So we don't think the contact with the two generals is a crime. It is our responsibility to find a solution.
Can you understand the reservations, however, that people might have on the part of the Sudanese armed forces that civilians do not feel comfortable with negotiating going on with a militia that has allegedly raped people, killed people and harmed them in different ways?
Unfortunately, to bring peace in Sudan, there is no opportunity to speak to angels. The two fighting sides committing serious crimes, again, is the Sudanese people. And the only way to end the fight in Sudan is through negotiation with those who are killing the people now to stop this and to choose an alternative path. So speaking to the fighting sides, we do not have any illusions about their track record of crimes. And we are so vocal in our criticism and condemnation for the violations by the two sides. But the dialogue with them is not to legitimize them, or it's not to make them innocent from these crimes. The dialogue with the two sides has one aim, is to bring peace to Sudan.
Who do you trust in this dialogue that you hope to bring?
I trust in the Sudanese people. The dialogue should not be exclusively for the two fighting parties. The dialogue should be inclusive to bring the civilian Sudanese organization, whether political parties, civil society, youth, women, because the future of Sudan should be decided by the Sudanese, not by the generals.
Over the past 18 months, there's been lots of talk about Sudan's framework agreement, which aims to put the power back in the hands of the civilians ultimately. Talks to finalise those details have ultimately failed. It's something that you've been heavily involved in. I wonder whether you think that framework agreement has any power or influence to bring a resolution to this conflict now.
The framework agreement was an attempt to avoid the war. We know that there are issues that could bring the war to Sudan. One of these issues is the issue of the fragmentation within the security sector. And the framework agreement came with a roadmap for reaching to a one unified professional army. So to achieve this goal without bloodshed. Also, the framework agreement tried to link the issue of the competition about power, instead of doing that by arms, doing that through elections. So it was a very brave attempt to avoid the war. And if the framework agreement could have been transferred to a final political agreement, Sudan might avoid bloodshed. But now there are serious developments in Sudan. And what was possible before the war, it is nearly impossible now. The issues are the same issues, but there is a need for a new approach to deal with these issues.
And is that new approach, in your opinion, going back to what you were saying about striking a conversation between the two sides, is that new approach solely based on negotiations between Sudanese armed forces and the RSF? Is that the only way forward?
Through an inclusive dialogue between the Sudanese to address the issues that keep bringing wars and instability to Sudan, and to agree on a new social contract for the Sudanese, for how they can build their country as a unified country, as a democratic country with one professional army.
How realistic do you think that goal is, considering the RSF is considered by many a group that do not honour any agreements?
The two fighting sides are committing crimes. They committed the coup against the transition. They were not honest in many deals that they had before. But it is not about the two sides. It's about the will of the Sudanese people. If the Sudanese people come together and form a strong platform and strong voice against the war that delegitimize the two fighting sides and delegitimize the war and put the power in the hand of the people, I think this will change the balance of power and it will affect the outcome of any upcoming dialogue.
Khaled Youssef there from Sudan's Tagadum Coalition. There are just 5 days of campaigning left until the US presidential election, and the opinion polls could barely be closer. Donald Trump has continued to campaign in battleground states after his marathon rally in New York at the weekend. Kamala Harris, meanwhile, spent yesterday in 3 swing states trying to urge supporters to get the vote out after a day that started with some damage limitation. Our correspondent Tom Bateman was in the press pool travelling with her.
This is Andrews Air Force Base on the tarmac next to Air Force 2, and we're awaiting the Vice President. But as she shows up here, a row about garbage. After the joke that was made by a comedian at the Trump rally in New York over the weekend, where he called Puerto Rico a floating island of garbage, the problem she has now is that President Biden referred to all this last night, saying the only garbage I see floating out there is his supporters. The Trump campaign have leapt on this, saying he's insulted half the country as the vice president is due to show up.
Good morning. Listen, I think that, first of all, he clarified his comments, but let me be clear, I strongly disagree with any criticism of people based on who they vote for.
And just to follow up on that, do you sympathize if any voters do feel offended?
Once again?
Do you sympathize with any voters who do feel offended by or insulted by the garbage comment?
I am running for president of the United States. I will be traveling to 3 states today to do what I have been doing throughout, which is talking with the American people. I get it in terms of the concerns they have about challenges like the price of groceries. My highest priority is to address that.
So as she put distance between herself and Biden, we got closer to the battlegrounds. The election is being fought in the dwindling middle, people who could still be persuaded for either Trump or Harris. So a rally in Raleigh, North Carolina.
So we're being led close to the stage. I can see the bulletproof glass in front of the podium. And a cheer coming up. I think as the crowd can tell that the motorcade has already arrived.
Wow. Wow. Hello, North Carolina.
It begins with a surprise warm-up act in front of these Democrat loyalists.
My name is Jennifer Bell. One thing we may not have a lot in common with is the fact that up until 2020, I consider myself an outspoken Republican voter. Yes, get it out. I deserve it.
This is the voter Harris wants to win over in the suburbs of North Carolina, that's right. Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. Women who would vote Republican but flinch at Donald Trump, particularly over his track record on abortion and reproductive rights.
Can we get another chance? When I say comma,
you say love, comma, comma.
But she still hasn't been able to budge the polling numbers enough after her party ousted Joe Biden. So this still feels more like a race of opposing negatives, where voters are asked to stop what they don't want. Next, in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, where the election could be decided.
As your president, I pledge to seek common ground and common sense solutions to the challenges you face.
In seats close to the stage, a man holds up a Palestinian flag and shouts, "You're a war criminal." It is the fourth time so far this has happened in a few hours. By the end of the day, there will be a fifth. It is a sign of how potent, how divisive this issue has become for the Democrats. Harris ends with a common refrain.
Do we believe in the promise of America? And are we ready to fight for it? And when we fight, we win. God bless you.
This does feel like the energy election. It's everywhere you turn. Harris rallies, Trump turning out his highly motivated fans. She has well outspent him, thanks to a late grassroots fundraising surge. But their bases are not the problem. It is turning out the people that don't show up to these mostly stage-managed events. They will be decisive in which way America turns on Tuesday.
Our correspondent Tom Bateman reporting for us there. You're listening to NewsHour here on the BBC World Service. I'm Krupa Bhatti with NewsHour live from the BBC in London. There are just 5 days to go until the US presidential election, and Kamala Harris and Donald Trump are in the Southwest hitting the campaign trail. They've both been making their final pitches to voters, and the gloves are off. Kamala Harris used the last major speech of her campaign to label former President Trump as a threat to democracy, describing her rival as consumed with grievance and out for unchecked power. Meanwhile, Donald Trump this week called the Harris campaign a campaign of hate. He added, "It's a very big, powerful party with smart people, but it's vicious and perhaps even trying to destroy our country." I've been getting the thoughts of Professor Francis Fukuyama, Senior Fellow at Stanford University's Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies and the author of The End of History. Does he think this is a routine election?
I think routine elections are about policy choices, you know, whether you should raise taxes or lower taxes. This election is much more significant because it's really about the survival of democratic institutions in the United States. Donald Trump has not just implemented policies that you may or may not like. He's attacked, you know, one of the most fundamental principles of any modern democracy, which is the willingness to step down after you lose an election. There's a long list of actions that he has very clearly stated he wants to take that will undermine, you know, our democratic institutions. And so that's really what the election is about, and not simply about, you know, the southern border or tariffs or other issues.
That is strong language, that this election is very much about the survival of democratic institutions rather than specific policy details. How do you believe America has got itself into this position?
Well, I think part of it is just people not paying attention. You know, I would say that maybe a third of Republican voters actually agree with Donald Trump. They want him to go after his enemies and do all these things. Another third are more moderate Republicans who just don't take him seriously. So even if he says he's going to round up, you know, 11 million illegal immigrants, they don't think it's going to happen. He's, you know, tried that in the past and it hasn't worked. And then another group, a significant group, are just not paying attention. They don't tune into politics and they don't understand what the real stakes are. And so between those three groups, I think that's how you get 50% of Americans seemingly being willing to support the re-election of Trump.
Turning my attention to the Harris campaign, the Trump campaign have accused the Democrats of using dangerous language, dangerous rhetoric, against Mr. Trump, including in the days, weeks and months that led up to those two assassination attempts. I wonder what's your take on the language being used and the to-ing and fro-ing going on here?
Well, I think it's just experimentation. You know, I think when she was first made the candidate, there was a hope that she could project an optimistic, a sunnier alternative to Trump, who's claiming that America is just a hellscape. And that was enough to get her up to, you know, where she is now, 49%, but not enough to get her above that point. And I think that as a result, she's now fallen back into, you know, the dangers of a Trump administration. That doesn't seem to be working either, because I think Americans at this point have a lot of information in both directions. And so they're kind of stuck at this 50-50 division. So we'll have to see.
Interesting use of the word experimentation. I wonder what you think of President Biden using the term garbage, for example, to allegedly describe Trump voters. Would you agree?
Well, that was, I think, basically the Republicans trying to exploit the fact that it wasn't clear whether there was an apostrophe before the S, you know, when he talked about the Trump voters. I don't think it's significant, and I don't think anybody is going to change their vote on the basis of, you know, that one offhand remark.
Looking further afield, you've written in the past that American foreign policy has fallen prey to domestic politics with devastating results for the future world order. That really stayed with me. Considering all of what we've seen in recent months in Gaza and in Ukraine, explain whether or not you stand by this position and what you mean by it.
Well, you know, I think that The first big issue that's going to come up will be Ukraine, because I believe that that fight is very, very important. Putin wants to upend the entire Europolan free order that emerged after the fall of the Berlin Wall. And he's doing it piece by piece. And I think if he is not stopped, he's going to continue. And that's going to have a big effect on Europe and American alliances. The other thing is that Trump is going to introduce a huge amount of uncertainty. So, for example, on China, he talks very tough, but he's really very reluctant to use force. He keeps saying that Biden is going to get us into World War III. And so it's not clear that he would, you know, come to the defense of Taiwan. And I think that kind of uncertainty is not good for international politics because, you know, for example, allies need to know whether they can actually count on the United States to support them if crunch time comes.
If Mr. Trump is reelected, I wonder what your thoughts will be on the state of the American electorate.
There's been a huge damage to American soft power, right? The soft power means the power that we project because people admire the United States. They think that the system is an exemplary democracy. And I think it gets harder and harder for people to maintain that belief when the country is willing to reelect somebody like Donald Trump. And I think that that's a kind of lasting damage that will be done to America's international image. And then domestically, I think that there's going to be a lot of conflict, beginning with likely conflict and possibly violence over just counting the votes in the coming election. And that also is not going to be a good look either for democracy generally or for the United States in particular.
So in your opinion, if Kamala Harris wins, is that the way to win back that soft power?
I don't think that election by itself is going to do the job. You know, people were hoping that if Biden were elected in 2020, that would restore America to its former place. But unfortunately, now there's this right-wing infrastructure in place that, beginning with contesting the election results themselves, is going to be constantly attacking a new Harris administration. She's probably not going to hold on to the Senate, so she will not have the kind of legislative support that Biden had. So she's going to have a tough time, and I imagine that any kind of restoration of America's image and role in the world is going to take, you know, longer than simply, you know, one vote on November 5th.
Francis Fukuyama from Stanford University there. That is it from this hour, from all of us here at NewsHour. Thank you for spending some of your day with us.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.